Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Well, thank you very much, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We hope that all of our listeners are having an enjoyable summer, and along those lines, our title of today's program is Sizzling Insurance Coverage Cases of 2018, the Mid-Year Report. And as we embark upon the second half of the year in the insurance world, we thought it would be a good time, as we have in the past, to look back and discuss some of the biggest insurance coverage cases of 2018 and look ahead at a couple of the cases to watch for later in the year. And no one has a better pulse on cases of interest to insurers and reinsurers than our guest today, Jeff Sestruck. Jeff is a senior insurance reporter at Law 360. He has reported on insurance law and regulation for Law 360 for the past several years. He is a journalism major, graduated from the University of Arkansas, and he previously worked for a couple of newspapers in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And Jeff is someone who obviously stays on top of the insurance coverage world, and he enlightens insurers, policyholders, practitioners, and courts alike on insurance cases. And he's become a regular guest on our program. And Jeff, I have to say, the favorite of our listeners. So we'd like to welcome you back to Insurance Law Radio.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, there's no shortage of interesting insurance coverage cases in 2018. And frankly, when I was looking back at some of the cases you were going to talk about, March seems to be a very prolific month for courts and insurance coverage. And Jeff wrote a couple of articles recently for Law 360, one on the biggest insurance decisions in 2018 mid-year report and another on insurance cases to watch in the second half of 2018. And those reports, along with one he did recently, I think it came out Monday, on four cases pending before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, will form the basis for the decisions we discuss. So why don't we kick it off, Jeff, and talk about some of these key decisions during the first half of 2018. And the first on your list is Keyspan versus Munich Re, decided by the New York High Court, the Court of Appeals, in March of this year. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the case and why you believe it to be significant?
Sure. So as you mentioned, March has become a prolific month for courts when it comes to major insurance decisions. The Keyspan case was one of two that the Court of Appeals decided on the same day. And it tops my list because of the potential implications for a number of long-tail insurance claims, particularly environmental and asbestos claims. In Keyspan, so a unanimous Court of Appeals affirmed a state appellate panel's ruling rejecting Keyspan Gas East Corporation's request to apply what's called an unavailability exception to the pro rata insurance allocation formula in a case involving coverage for environmental contamination claims. And just to explain the background to this unavailability exception, when you have a pro rata scheme, a policyholder generally pay a share of its own long-tail liability costs for years when it had no policies in place. If the unavailability exception is applied, the policyholder doesn't have to cover costs incurred during periods when it was unable to buy a specific type of insurance in the marketplace. And in this particular case, past a certain year, insurance for pollution-related risks generally became unavailable. And so Keyspan had sought to have its insurers, particularly Century Indemnity Company, fill the gaps in its coverage that were created when the insurance market stopped taking those risks on by and large. But what the Court of Appeals said was, under a pro rata allocation formula, you're limiting indemnification on the insurer's part to losses and occurrences happening during the policy period. So the Court of Appeals said the unavailability rule, which would, in essence, put insurance carriers on the hook for claims, costs related to claims that occurred outside of their policy period, is inconsistent with time on the risk pro rata allocation. So this ruling was a victory for insurance carriers, especially those operating in New York State, and had the effect of limiting their exposure to years in which they had policies on the risk. So I think it could have wide-ranging effects on similar cases in New York, and given the level of influence the Court of Appeals has, potentially nationwide.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was a brilliant and correct decision by New York's High Court. And the unavailability issue kicked in really for two time frames. The policyholder there alleged that insurance coverage wasn't available in the market before 1925. Or after some point in the 70s by virtue of policies containing pollution exclusions. And, of course, this decision put both ends of that to rest and, consistent with the regular rules of pro rata allocation, did not carve out an unavailability of insurance exception. And as I've said in the past, the notion of a pro rata allocation and allocating to the policyholder for any periods where there is no insurance for whatever reason go together like peanut butter and jelly. And, an interesting little bit of a contrast between the Keyspan decision was the Honeywell decision decided by the New Jersey Supreme Court a couple months later in June of this year, where the New Jersey Supreme Court decided to adhere to its unavailability of insurance exception to the general rule of pro rata allocation, where policyholders are responsible for damages taking place in periods where they are uninsured. And at least the majority, there was a dissent, but the majority declined to depart from the unavailability exception that court itself really created in its 1994 decision in Owens, Illinois. In Honeywell, the insurers asked the New Jersey Supreme Court to carve out an equitable exception to the unavailability rule on the grounds that Bendix, which is the Honeywell corporate predecessor, continued to manufacture asbestos-containing brakes for about 14 years after insurance allegedly ceased to be offered for asbestos claims. But the majority of the New Jersey Supreme Court felt that the circumstances of the case did not warrant deviating from the unavailability rule. And it emphasized Honeywell sought coverage only for the claims alleging initial exposure to asbestos before 1987, when the policies covered such risks. So that was the decision there, and there really was what I thought was a cogent dissent in that case that said really to be true with a pro rata allocation in the spirit of Owens, Illinois, the policyholder should be allocated those losses. It was Justice Albin's dissent there. So I guess if you look at these two cases, you look at Keyspan, no unavailability exception, and Honeywell keeping the unavailability exception, you say, well, what's the difference? Both New Jersey and New York are pro rata allocation jurisdictions. And I think the difference lies in the rationale behind applying a pro rata allocation. In New York, it's strictly contract-based. You look at the contract language, and it's limited to injury or damage during the policy period, and the court is going to enforce that language and not allow reasons of policy to override that. In New Jersey, the New Jersey Supreme Court's jurisprudence, starting in Owens, Illinois, has been that public policy considerations require a pro rata allocation, that the policies themselves don't answer the question. And so we see this difference of the basis for a pro rata allocation, whether it's contract or public policy, play out in other ways. For example, in the decision you wrote about and we talked about previously, Jeff, in Viking Pump, the New York High Court said that non-cumulation clauses change that result. New Jersey, the New Jersey Supreme Court has previously said that we're not allowing a non-cumulation clause to change the result of a pro rata allocation because our approach is based on policy. So that's a little bit of an explanation for why two key coverage jurisdictions both apply pro rata allocation. One has an unavailability exception, the other does not. And I guess, Jeff, the other takeaway maybe from Keyspan is adherence to what you and I have talked about before, which is New York continues to be strongly a presumptive pro rata jurisdiction.
Right. And yeah, so this this decision, you know, weighed in on one of the, you know, the outstanding issues that have come up in the context of pro rata allocation. So the, you know, the courts will continue to, you know, to assess the all the remaining pro rata debates in New York State and elsewhere. And I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up seeing another asbestos or environmental contamination case before the New York Court of Appeals over the next year or two.
Yeah, it seems to have an appetite for hearing those sorts of cases. Jeff, let's move on to the next decision, which is Gilbane TDX versus St. Paul. That's the second New York Court of Appeals decision decided that day. The issue in that case was whether a construction manager qualifies as an additional insured under a general contractor's policy. And I guess the word "with" makes all the difference in the world.
It did. And this case was decided the same day as Keyspan. So the Court of Appeals seemed to want to get all of its insurance matters out of the way at once. And as you mentioned, this the outcome of this case turned on that single word. So in a 5-2 opinion, the New York Court of Appeals upheld an appellate ruling that construction manager, which was a joint venture between Gilbane and TDX Construction Corporation, was not an additional insured under its prime contractor's CGL policy with Liberty Unit. So the prime contractor in this case, I'll just give a little background, had agreed in a contract with the financier, the Dormitory Authority of New York, to acquire additional insured coverage for a number of other companies on the project, including the construction manager. And basically what Gilbane TDX had said was that agreement between the prime contractor and the financier rendered it an additional insured under an LIU, Liberty Insurance Underwriters Policy Endorsement. But the five-judge majority on the Court of Appeals said no. They said that the policy endorsement in question clearly required Gilbane TDX to enter into a direct written contract with the prime contractor to qualify for additional insured coverage. And as Associate Judge Rowan D. Wilson wrote for the court, said that the Gilbane joint venture's argument was incorrect. The endorsement is facially clear and doesn't provide for coverage unless the joint venture isn't an organization with whom Samson has a written contract. So the Court of Appeals took a very policy language, intensive approach to interpreting the coverage issue here, and basically said, rejected this notion that there was any sort of ambiguity, said that phrase "with whom" means you have to have a direct contract between the party seeking additional insured coverage and the party that's obtained the policy or the named insured on that policy. And so this case was closely watched by the construction industry, and given the number of contracts and subcontracts involved in construction projects, there was a lot of buzz about the decision. And in fact, just a couple of months after Gilbane was decided, it was applied for the first time by First Department appellate panel there in New York, which cited Gilbane to support a conclusion that Turner Construction Company and one of its architectural firms couldn't claim additional insured coverage under a contractor's policy for a construction site accident because Turner and the firm did not have a direct contract. So this is a case that it turned on one word, potentially has had sweeping implications, for the construction industry.
Well, and "with" is a key word. I mean, either you're with me or you're against me. And so one can certainly understand why the court came out the way it did, even though the putative insured actually had some interesting extrinsic evidence. But the court failed to refuse to consider it because it was an unambiguous contract, and you don't look at extrinsic evidence. And the other thing that's interesting about it is there was no insurance provided, but that does not mean that there wasn't a breach of contract in terms of a party failing to secure insurance when it's contractually committed to do so. So let's move on to the next case, which is MS Communications versus Illinois National Insurance Company, D&O case from the Southern District of Indiana. How could this little old decision make your list?
So this one made a lot of noise among the policyholder bar, likely because of the potential for an appellate decision down the road. Now, so the in this case, an Indiana federal judge refused to apply an interrelated wrongful acts exclusion in a D&O policy held by MS Communications Corporation to preclude coverage for MS's cost to defend a stockholder suit accusing the company's board of attempting to deprive investors of their rights. So the reason a lot of policyholder attorneys were, I suppose, delighted by the decision is because of the frequency with which the interrelated wrongful acts exclusion is cited in D&O coverage disputes. So here, the insurance carrier, Illinois National Insurance Company, had sought to rely on this interrelated wrongful acts exclusion, which, and this is a mouthful here, so bear with me, excluded coverage for, quote, any claim alleging, arising out of, based upon, attributable to, or in any way related directly or indirectly, in part or in whole, to an interrelated wrongful act, which Illinois National had argued would include all the suits filed after MS had a failed go private attempt. So the district judge here said that if he decided to apply the literal interpretation of that exclusion proposed by Illinois National, there would indeed be no coverage for the lawsuits against Emmis, but he said that the result would be nonsensical. And so, you know, what the policyholder bar has extrapolated from this decision is the notion that exclusions, should not be literally applied if they would have the effect of negating coverage for virtually any lawsuit arising from, a certain fact pattern, particularly if that fact pattern arises often in the policyholder's line of business. So the court, the case is headed to trial, and the judge had denied Illinois National's motion for an interlocutory appeal to the Seventh Circuit. But I presume that we'll at some point down the road be looking at an appeal of the district judge's decision on the interrelated act, wrongful acts exclusion. And that ultimate decision could end up having more, more precedential or widespread value.
Well, and it's the age-old problem confronting insurers, which is when you don't write a Katie bar the door, complete, full, airtight exclusion, courts will say, well, if you wanted to exclude something, you should have been clear. And then when there is a very clear, solid, plain exclusion, you hear some courts, unfortunately, say, well, that exclusion is very clear, but if we apply it as written, it would be a very plain and well-enforced exclusion, so we're not going to do that. So you go into the situation where there are just some judges, insurance language will never satisfy because they're looking for a result. And speaking of interesting results, we move on to Liberty versus Ledesma. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. And Meyer Construction Company, a big-time California Supreme Court decision dealing with coverage for sexual molestation claims under a CGL policy. Jeff, why don't you fill us in on that case?
Sure. So this decision was a long time coming out of the California Supreme Court. It attracted a huge amount of attention from various industry groups on both sides of the bar, as well as institutions that are vulnerable to or face a significant number of claims over improper failure to vet employees or manage those employees, including the LA Unified School District, some Catholic and evangelical Christian organizations, and the on the another side of the legal landscape, the National Association for the Protection of Crime Victims also weighed in with an amicus brief. So the stakes here were very high. And what the California Supreme Court said in response to a certified question from the Ninth Circuit was that claims that an employer is negligent in hiring, retention, or supervision of a worker who intentionally injures a third party does trigger a general liability policy's coverage for an accidental occurrence, which is defined as an unexpected, unforeseen, or undesigned happening or consequence from a known or unknown cause. So what, in this case, the facts were, were very, very sensitive. You had a construction company who hired a known sex offender who was later convicted of assaulting a student while working on a construction project at a California middle school. So the construction company argued and the California Supreme Court agreed was that regardless of the atrocious and traumatic nature of the Employees Act, the company's own negligent failure to properly screen or monitor that employee was indeed an occurrence. And so as Associate Justice Carol Corrigan wrote for the court, absent an applicable exclusion, employers may legitimately expect coverage for such claims under comprehensive general liability insurance policies, just as they do for other claims of negligence. So I think from the standpoint of California-based employers in a variety of industries, this decision came as a relief. I think it could be applied in any number of contexts, even outside of the unfortunate facts of this particular case. So that's why it landed on my list.
Well, yes, and interesting from the standpoint that the court noted there that what the basis of liability for the company, the insured, was the negligent supervision. And so it looked to that as opposed to the intentional act of its employee. So I think that was the key fact in that case. And the interesting thing about it is, while that's going on in California, we've got the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling the month before, I think, that in Tully versus Mustafa, that there was no coverage for negligent supervision of an employee. A little bit different fact scenario. You got a guy, Tally, walks into Mustafa's convenience store to buy a beer. I don't know if he also got a beef jerky, but we know he bought beer. And while he was inside the store, Mustafa's security guard punched him in the face twice. And Tally filed suit alleging that Mustafa had a duty to train and supervise its employee. And the insurer, auto owners who provided business owners liability coverage, argued there was no coverage, there was no occurrence, and the court in that case agreed, but a lot of it, happened to turn on the nature of the allegations, because there was pretty specific allegations that the employer was negligent in that it should have trained an employee not to intentionally punch a customer in the face. And the court did point out that its decision does not mean that a negligent supervision claim will never trigger insurance coverage, but it noted that there were no factual allegations that Mustafa knew or should have known that its security guard was likely to punch a customer in the face, and there was no facts alleging Mustafa acted in a specific way that led to the employees punching the customer in the face. So sort of a pleading, in some of these cases, turn on what's actually pled. And sometimes the results can be altered depending upon what's actually alleged, particularly with respect to a duty to defend or what's proven with respect to a duty to indemnify. And so that takes us on to a case that really sent shockwaves throughout the insurance industry, the Allstate decision of the Intermediate Washington Court of Appeals, also in March of this year. I want to just say briefly a word about that case.
Sure. So the Washington Appellate Court I'm going to do my best here, Kiyodala versus Allstate Insurance Company case.
You're a good man. See, I avoided saying Kiyodala, so that was good.
I probably should have followed suit. In this case, the Allstate case, the appellate panel set new Washington State precedent when it ruled that insurance adjusters can be found individually liable for bad faith and breaches of consumer protection laws. So here the panel overruled a trial court and found that an Allstate policyholder could file an individual bad faith claim against an Allstate adjuster in a dispute over an auto accident coverage claim. And as the basis of that decision, the panel said that the relevant state law makes no distinction between corporations and individuals. So as Judge J. Robert Leach put it in the opinion, nothing in the statute limits the duty of good faith to corporate insurance adjusters or relieves individual insurance adjusters from that duty. So from the the perspective of the policyholder bar, the panel's ruling could potentially convey some litigation advantages on policyholders and coverage disputes, some of them procedural. For example, if the policyholder and adjuster are citizens of the same state, the adjuster's insurance company may not be able to remove the case to federal court on diversity jurisdiction grounds. And also, when an adjuster is named as defendant, the insurance company may not be able to shield him or her from having to testify at trial. So the testimony of the adjuster, may end up having implications for the outcome of the case for both the claims against the adjuster and also the claims against the insurance company that employs them. So, yeah, this is a case that I think could wind up before the Washington State Supreme Court, so we'll have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, and just again to repeat, in case some people were knocked over when we said so, at the beginning, under this intermediate Washington Court of Appeals decision, an individual adjuster can be personally liable for bad faith and for violations of Washington's Consumer Protection Act. And there is actually a prior decisional authority going the other way. I guess what we should also point out is that previously the Washington Supreme Court in the Perex case held that an Insurance Fair Conduct Act regulatory violation does not create an independent private cause of action for a violation. And this appellate decision went along with it and said, okay, no liability under the Insurance Fair Conduct Act, but there is potential liability for an adjuster for bad faith and for a violation of the Consumer Protection Act. And we'll wait and see what happens with that. And finally, in terms of cases decided recently, the Delaware Supreme Court once again tried its hand at determining New York law in the In Re TIAA case, and in that case held that coverage was available for lawsuits seeking disgorgement in the context of that particular case. And Jeff, you know that the court did exactly the opposite of what I suggested that it would do or should do.
The Delaware Supreme Court in that case, I was a little surprised by the brief treatment of the disgorgement issues, and it appeared that the court's ultimate conclusion rested on the nature of TIA's investment services and this finding that basically, as the investors had alleged, that by delaying the withdrawal or transfer of funds, that TIAA was profiting. But the Delaware Supreme Court said that given the structure of the program, and to the extent that there was a difference between the value of an investment account when an investor requested a withdrawal and when it was actually processed, that those the difference in the value of the account was potentially spread among the rest of the account holders. So it seemed like a fairly fact-specific result in that case, I was, like I said, a little surprised to see that they didn't go further in analyzing the issue, but they, appeared to distinguish prior New York precedent on coverage for disgorgement and other penalties from the facts of this case.
Well, Jeff, ladies and gentlemen, this shows you what a great man Jeff is, because I just sprung this case on him. He wasn't planning on talking about it, and yet you did a great job with it. Let's just spend our final 2 or 3 minutes, Jeff, if we could, talking about a couple of cases to watch in the second half of 2018. There's a case before the Texas Supreme Court of interest.
Sure. So if you're really into cases that are involve extremely technical analysis of policy language, this case will be of interest. So the stakes here are high. This is the case of Anadarko Petroleum versus Houston Casualty Company, which has garnered the attention of many policyholders in the oil and gas industries. So from the 20,000-foot view, the case deals with Anadarko's appeal of a ruling that it isn't entitled to coverage from underwriters at Lloyd's of London for any of over $100 million it has spent defending against claims arising from the Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil spill. So the core issue here, I think, you know, couldn't be more technical. The crux of the Texas appellate panel's opinion against Anadarko was its finding that defense costs constitute a liability under Anadarko's energy package policy, and that finding triggered the application of a policy provision capping the underwriter's overall limits for Anadarko's liabilities arising out of any joint venture operations, which its role in the Deepwater Horizon project was as part of a joint venture. So this, you know, as I mentioned before, some oil and gas industry trade groups have filed amicus briefs supporting Anadarko before the Texas Supreme Court. And they've said that given the prevalence of these joint venture provisions, a ruling affirming the lower court and going in favor of the Lloyd's underwriters could have the effect of constricting the availability of coverage for energy companies' defense costs in similar cases. So, like I said, you know, as it was with the Gilbane TDX decision, I think this is going to end up turning on the minutiae of the policy language, but the impact on the energy industry could be fairly broad.
Well, Jeff, I guess we maybe could have come up with a different title for this episode, fitting with the summer theme. We could have called it Gone Fishing. And there's a group of what I'll call fishing cases, although these are fishing with a PH. Before the Second Circuit, there's a case before the Sixth Circuit and a case before the 11th Circuit, essentially addressing the issue of whether or not fishing is covered under computer crime policies, correct? So there are those three cases pending, Jeff, all involving phishing. Go ahead and reel them in for us very quickly.
Will do. So this was a huge issue that attracted attention from both sides of the insurance bar. And generally speaking, the question that's confronted courts all over the country has been, do traditional commercial crime policies cover claims for these phishing or sometimes they're also called social engineering schemes where you have criminals using emails and phone calls to pose as corporate executives in order to manipulate a company's employees into wiring money to fraudulent bank accounts. And so there's been quite a bit of activity in this space just in the past month. Two circuit courts of appeals have weighed in. The Second Circuit in the Metadata versus Federal Insurance case, and the Sixth Circuit in the American Tooling versus Travelers case. And what both of the courts of appeals said was that the crime policy language, read on its face, provided coverage for these social engineering losses, even though those types of schemes may not have existed when the policies were first sold. So that's those two decisions have put a spotlight on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is considering yet another social engineering coverage case in the matter of Principal Solutions Group versus Ironshore Indemnity Company. And the district court in that case came down in favor of the policyholder. And I noticed on the dockets in the principal case that the parties have cited to the recent decisions in the Metadata and American Tooling Center cases. So the outcomes in those two cases that were recently decided may end up having an impact on the 11th Circuit's forthcoming ruling in principal.
Well, very good. Interesting times, obviously. We're expecting a lot more flow of cases involving the world of cyber coverage in one form or another. It's something that I don't know if it'll prove to be the next asbestos, but I think we're going to see a lot of coverage claims and issues for many years to come. Jeff, just in the final moment, there's one more Second Circuit decision I know you wanted to at least alert our listeners to.
Absolutely. So this is another issue that has been percolating through many circuit courts of appeals over the last few years. And the question at the core of this case is, at what point is insurance company's duty to defend triggered in an SEC investigation? The case is Patriarch Partners LLC versus Axis Insurance Company, and it involves Patriarch's efforts to secure defense coverage for the costs of an SEC investigation and enforcement action. The lower court here concluded that coverage was barred because the probe predated the insurer's policy. And so the question here becomes, at what point can you say an investigation has actually begun? Patriarch, the insured here, has said that the SEC probe did not formally get underway until the investment firm was served with its first subpoena in February 2012. The district judge, Valerie Caproni, ruled below that the investigation began when the agency issued its initial order of investigation in early June 2011. So the Second Circuit is going to have to look at this and decide for purposes of coverage under Patriarch's D&O policy with Axis what constitutes the beginning of an SEC investigation, and its answer to that will determine whether or not Axis coverage was triggered under the D&O policy.
Well, Jeff, once again, we love to thank you for joining us here on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. Folks, just keep following Jeff in Law 360, and you will find out how that decision is decided, as well as keeping abreast of all of the insurance coverage decisions we live and die for. We look forward, Jeff, to reading your articles, and we'll have you back here again in January when the weather's a lot cooler, and we'll wrap up all of the key decisions for 2018. Thanks to all of you, our listeners, for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. If you have any topic or guest suggestion for a future broadcast, please let us know. We look forward to speaking to you soon on the next episode of Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Take us home, Royal Oaks.
You've been listening to Hinshon Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio. Radio.